overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change. You create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
Well, it's so good to see everybody who was courageous enough to come out this day. You know, I've been hearing all about this, what do you call it, social distance that we're here to. And Glory G and I were going to show you how to do that. We didn't get around to that theatrical, but I think you get the idea. To use common sense in your engagement with people. And God knows this center is big enough, there are enough chairs that you don't have to worry. You can have a row all to yourself if you choose this Sunday. And for all of you who've called me, who are listening or watching on live streaming, you're here with us in our hearts. I discovered when I walked in and saw Gigi and Adam that I need my tribe a little bit, because the world can kind of scare you out there with all of its drama and its hysteria. When you're as old as I am, you have enough life experience to meet fear with a different way of approaching it. There was a time at the center when things got really chaotic, and I had a board that was very critical of me because there was a member of the congregation, it was Charlie Johnson, who was flirting with the ladies, and I was told to throw him out of the church. And I said, I don't operate that way. Charlie's just a flirt, what can I say? Well, I got letters, I was told I needed to resign. I was really almost ready to quit at that particular stage. And I was Saturday morning, and I was preparing for the sermon on Sunday, and I was reading a magazine called Parabola. And in that, there was a story of Jesus when he had been preaching on the hillside, and he was exhausted. And he said, I'm going to go to sleep on the boat, and take me around the Sea of Galilee, and whatever you do, don't wake me up. I need my sleep. Well, then, according to the story, there was a storm on the sea, and the apostles grew sorely afraid, and they woke up, Master, Master, there's this storm that's a-brewing. And he said, ah, there you are. You took the storm on the outside, and you put it on the inside. And in that moment, I had this like epiphany. Whatever that drama goes on with that group of people that said I'm a horrible leader had nothing to do with me, but I had taken the storm on the outside and had put it on the inside. So I learned at that time, almost 30 years ago, not to take this trauma that's out there and then place it in here and then create anxiety. Now, I'm not great at it. I do my very best. When Humphrey was paralyzed from the neck down, I must admit, the storm on the outside had moved on the inside. And as Jody Rutenberg says, you know what it's like now to be a mother, because I did not sleep or eat for 3.5 days, but I held that little life that I was responsible for. And sometimes people like us carry this responsibility in our shoulders. Anybody resemble that besides me? I felt this huge responsibility for Humphrey. I feel the responsibility for all y'all. And that's okay, because ultimately, responsibility is the ability to respond to whatever life brings you in hopefully a more skillful way. And so there is a prayer that I learned from Helen Street. She said, this is the only prayer you'll ever need, so listen and listen tight.
What is he? What's the prayer you only need? The only prayer you need must be really powerful, says Bert.
It is. And this is what the prayer is. To the universe, to God, whatever you want to call, to this greater intelligence, assist me in assuming the consciousness that is required to meet what life brings me. Dear universe, assist me in choosing or arising at that peaceful, I use the word equanimity. You know, in equanimity, when true nature flowers, there's an equanimity. It means that when the darkness comes, it's just as cherished as the light. So we don't try to push away fear, but in a strange sort of way, we embrace fear. We're teaching this wonderful class in April when we resume classes, and it's called The Joy of True Meditation. And I asked Adam to read that little section where Jeff Foster writes a letter to Vincent van Gogh. And basically he says, you were an evolutionary throw forward. You saw light where other people saw form. And he says, could I be there to embrace you, to hold you when you're judged by the world as different? So what if when we see the crazy things happening out there, we're here as that space, that holding space that gets to love each other when fear arises? Now, fear is going to arise, and there's an acronym for fear that I learned 30 years ago, which is false evidence appearing real. Well, I'm not going to say that the coronavirus is false evidence appearing real, but the other acronym for fear, which works better for me, is forgetting that everything is really all right. In the midst of this fear out there in the world, everything is truly all right, and when you align yourself to that, then you move through moment to moment to moment, not jumping out into this chaos that the world would hand you. When I moved to New York City right after graduating from college in 1972, everybody says, don't go in Central Park, they'll mug you. Don't go in the subway system, it's not a safe place. And so I lived in fear for maybe 6 months until I said, you know, it's too painful to live in fear. And I lived right next to Central Park. So every morning when I'd walk to work, I'd walk down through Central Park. And when I left work, I'd walk back through Central Park. And in the 5 years I lived there, I didn't have any problems. I used that subway system like it was my right hand. And all I did was move out of fear and into an abiding sense that all is well in my world. So what if we could, in this dance that we're doing right now with COVID-19, is that what it's called? Is to use common sense and not to buy into the fear, but as that beautiful treatment, let me bring the peace to the world that the peace needs. When we had a beautiful man here named David Tharp, and he was a godsend. Some of you got to meet him. And when he was over in India, he was a hugger like me. And I have to admit, I love to hug you, and I'm hugging you right now. And so David went to hug this woman from India, and she said, we are not allowed to hug men, much less other people. And he says, well, what am I going to do? And she said, you may hug me with your eyes. Or her words were better, you may embrace me with your eyes. So he said, the whole time I was in India, I was embracing people with my eyes. When Gigi and I went to Turkey and we were traveling with the Sufis, you're not allowed to touch in the Muslim community either, especially the Muslim women. They're only allowed to be touched by their husband or their family. And so when you would see a Muslim, what you would do is you would touch your heart, you would look at them in the eyes, and you would bow to them. So my suggestion is that we embrace each other with our eyes, that we touch our hearts, that we bow to one another, and we don't take it personally. Now, if you need a hug, I am available, because I truly don't have anything except a wide-open heart. But I want to use common sense, and I want to respect people's boundaries, if that's possible. But I also want to open to the mystery of this. Adam, when I saw him this morning, he said, I think something wonderful is going to come out of this. If nothing else, it's going to make us more conscious of each other, and hopefully the heart of compassion will awaken. This month I'm speaking on the mystery, and Virginia Burroughs showed up in class this Wednesday, and she brought this little statement on the mystery from Rachel Naomi Raymonds, who was a medical doctor. She wrote a wonderful book called Kitchen Wisdom for the Soul. And sometimes when you get to be as old as I am, there is a certain amount of wisdom that you can only get from having lived a long life. Having had a few 2x4s, a few wake-up calls, give you a perspective that is no longer trying to fix the world. And so my colleague Maureen Hoyt from Los Angeles, we were talking about what's going on the planet, and she shared with me this Rachel Naomi Raymonds quote that said, we in this healing profession are really not here to fix the world. We're not here even to heal the world. But what we are is to serve the world. And so when you use that servant's heart, how can I serve this moment the best? Adam saw a homeless man on the side of the road, and he went past him and then circled around back and said, I am here to serve this man, and drove him all the way to Tennessee. And I says, you know, that was for you, Adam. And he says, yeah, I know it. And I told the man when I looked him in the eyes, what a gift you gave me, the opportunity to serve. And so what if the mystery works in strange sort of ways? I met a crazy young man in my driveway on Friday morning who had an epileptic seizure right in my driveway so that I could be there for him. That was mine to serve. And then, of course, Trey says, you keep attracting these strange people to you, don't you, David? I guess so. I don't know. It's the mystery at work. But, you know, I love it that way. I love it that way. So here's what Rachel Naomi Raymond says about the mystery. And I'm speaking this month about the mystery. She says, a sense of mystery can take us beyond disappointments and judgment to a place of cheerful expectancy. It opens in us an attitude of listening and a respect. And if one has in them this dimension of the unknown, then possibility is present at all times. You see, the mind wants the known. The mind wants to understand, but the soul that you sang about wants meaning. It's perfectly comfortable with uncertainty. Emerson says that, you know, it's we all seek to be certain, but only to the degree that we are uncertain is there any hope for us. So what if the mystery is about stepping into that uncertainty, seeing it as an opportunity for possibility? He said, wisdom is possible at all times, especially in those times like we're in today. And the mystery in one may speak to them and heal them, knowing that this enables us to listen to life from the place in us that is mystery also. Could the mystery in me meet the mystery in you? Mystery requires that we relinquish an endless search for answers, that's the mind again, and become willing to not understand. The willingness to not understand, to say that I don't have the answers. You know, one of the greatest prayers is, I don't have a clue what to say here, but I know that the universe does. That oversoul that Emerson spoke about, when I tap into it, it lives with equanimity and peace. It doesn't live in problems that need to be fixed. It's a whole different way of seeing the world. And those who witness life may eventually know far more than anyone can understand. Know far more than anyone can understand. You know, you could ask yourself then, what does the universe know through me? Could we know that when life gives us these abgos, another bloody growth opportunity, that they're really here for us to set us free from our idea that the security looks a certain way, that there's something greater trying to emerge? He says, perhaps real wisdom lies in not seeking answers at all. Huh. Not seeking answers at all. She goes on to say, the important thing is that mystery does happen and offers us the opportunity to wonder together and to reclaim a sense of awe and a sense of aliveness. She says, and Gigi will like this, the feathers that fall into our lives offer neither proof nor certainty, but they are just reminders to stay awake and to listen, because the mystery at the heart of life may speak to you at any time. And every time anyone becomes more transparent to the light in themselves, they will restore the light in the world. That last sentence. Every time anyone becomes more transparent to the light in themselves, they will restore the light in the world. In our final classes on Tuesday and Wednesday, the students do projects, and Raul sang a song, The Prayer of St. Francis. But before that, he did a prayer that he and Gigi do every day. In essence, what it said was, I release all judgment to the light. I don't like the word release. I'd rather I surrender. So I changed his little prayer to, I surrender my judgment to the light. I surrender my fear into the light. You know, this light that we all share, the one light of the presence, moves through us. Could we be transparent to that and offer that to the world? I had breakfast with Wanda Gale Campbell, and she's come off a long period of silence, and I was kind of flattered that in that coming off the silence, she wanted to have communion with me over breakfast. And she shared, after spending a month in total silence, that she came back with certain realizations that everything is perfect just as it is, and that it's my reaction to the world that creates the suffering. And then she told me that in her silence, she had read a book by Robert Fulghum, who wrote, Everything You Ever Needed to Learn, You Learned in Kindergarten. You know, that we're here to walk each other home, that we're here to play together, that we're here to love one another. But she said he told the story of a man named Papadopoulos, who was a Greek, who was raised during World War II, was a little boy. And there was a bombing on his island, and he found a broken mirror by a dead soldier. And he was a little boy, and the mirror was in the pocket or by the side of the dead person. And he took a shard of that mirror, and he had kept it with him his whole life. And by the time that he was speaking to an audience about the wisdom of a long-lived life, Robert Fulghum went up and asked him, he said, what is the meaning of life? You know, that question that we all don't have an answer for. And he said, I'd like to answer that, if I may. And he pulled his wallet out, and he had taken that shard of the mirror that he had found by that soldier's body, and he had rubbed it down until it was a little circle. And he carried that mirror with him everywhere he went. And he pulled that mirror out of his wallet, and he caught the rays of the sun, and he shone it on Robert Fulghum. And he says, I believe each one of us is a piece of the one light of God, and we're here to shine our light into the world as best we can. So here you got the mystery of Naomi Raymond saying the same thing. When our light can be transparent, and it's the light shining through us. Now, that's a metaphor again. Jesus used it. He says, don't put your light under a bushel, but let it shine. The Buddha said, be a light unto the world. So what if in this time of darkness, our job is to shine just a little bit of light, a little bit of humor, a little bit of reflection of the source, not to get caught up in the tyranny of the little mind, of the troubled soul. Jean gave me such a beautiful gift this morning when she carried in her soul and let me hold her in my arms, and I'm grateful she did. And I had been studying over the weekend, this whole week, a book called The Care of the Soul. And in this, Thomas More talks about the soul as this, and even in religious science, they talk about it as the repository of every aspect of ourself. And so sometimes the soul has unhealed parts of ourself. There's little fearful Freddy. There's little controlling Curtis. They're all in there. And I was listening to Ajashanti in one of his current talks, and he says, the spiritual awakening is really going into the soul and expunging it of all those unhealed parts. And he said, for those of us who can really do spiritual mind treatment well, oftentimes we have exiled parts of ourselves that get stuck in that soul. And when something like COVID-19 happens, fearful Freddy might come up. I had a nightmare last night that I have this nightmare recurrently that I'm running away from something, and I find myself with garments on, in water, thinking the garments are going to drag me down. And then I wake up from this dream, like, what am I running from? Where am I running toward? I don't know. And it's like there's something in the subjective mind that's afraid, that wants to be met. And so what if we could embrace that part of the soul? Jeff Foster, I'm going to start with him. We're teaching him soon. And it's funny, the bookmark is from Ephesus in Turkey, when Gigi and I were in Ephesus. And it must be significant. But Jeff Foster talks about embracing everything that comes. He talks about becoming intimate with life. And when life gives us those nightmares, when life gives us the news, the fear on the planet, even the word pandemic is scary as hell, isn't it? The word pandemic? I mean, my goodness gracious. So here's what he says. Paradoxically, when we realize how perfect life is, how everything happens exactly as it should, we are freer than ever to go into the world and change things for better. It's all perfect just as it is. And you know how it's perfect? Because it is. And so there are no accidents that young man had the epileptic seizure in my driveway. There are no accidents that Adam drove past that homeless man on the side of the road. It's all perfect that you came here this Sunday morning. He says, you no longer coming from a rude assumption that the world is a broken thing that needs fixing. You see that everyone is already whole. You know, a mystic sees things in wholeness, whereas the fragmented mind sees things in parts. This one's right, this one's wrong, but the whole sees an essential wholeness. So he says, you no longer come from this assumption that the world is broken, that needs fixing, but you see that there's a wholeness amidst it all. And out of the depths of that deeper realization, you point back to the inherent wholeness of life. And rooted in this wholeness, you are free to fully engage with the dance of apparent separation. Apparent separation. The first separation is that we think we're separate from God or the universe. We think we're separate from our neighbor. We think we're separate from the planet. And it's all us. So Dr. Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind said something so profoundly simple, most of the world can't grasp it. He said, the perception of wholeness is all healing. Can you take that one in? The perception of wholeness, when we realize that we're really whole, right now, right where we are, but as Plato said, we need each other to be complete, so I need you to hold me when I get lost. I need Glory G to remind me when my sadness comes up. If I look a little deeper into that sadness, it'll take me right into love. So what if the wholeness is there, but oftentimes there's an obstacle to it? Virginia Burroughs said to me on Wednesday, she quoted that wonderful Rumi quote, that said, you know, it's not that the soul needs love for it to be fulfilled, but rather that the soul needs to observe where there are obstacles to that love that are keeping the love from flowing. So what if we could meet those obstacles to that love that arise from a troubled soul oftentimes, and when they're just seen in a new light, seen in the wholeness, they let go of their hold. They're not a bad thing after all. There's a little boy in me that wants to be loved and held. And so I have finally found him. He says, you're no longer coming from this rude assumption. So when you're no longer trying to fix life or yourself, perhaps you can be a great help to life. My teacher, Kennedy Schultz, had a wonderful, wicked sense of humor. He says, you're not here to solve all the problems of the world. He says, just make sure you're not one of them. Oops. I think that's funny. So he says, when you're no longer trying to fix other people, perhaps you can be a great blessing to them. And perhaps true healing happens when you get out of your own way. Huh. Perhaps that is what life needs more than anything. People who no longer see problems, but who see the inseparability of themselves with the world and who fully engage with the world from a place of deep acceptance of things as they are, and a fearless engagement with life are one and the same, however paradoxical that sounds to the rational mind. To see life with new eyes. A happy person sees beauty in the same place that an unhappy person sees ugliness. I am beautiful, you are beautiful, the whole existing universe is beautiful. Ugliness is a manifestation in perception of unhappiness. So I was joy-filled when I saw the people in Italy on their balconies singing opera to one another. You know, they weren't going to let this fear get the best of them. They were going to let their hearts rejoice and sing out, you know, amidst this, you know, to walk each other home, to hold that space for each other. And so back to the care of the soul, Thomas More, where this whole talk is supposed to spawn from. And this is what he says. He says, care of the soul sees another reality altogether than the one that appears to be. It appreciates the mystery of our human suffering and does not offer the illusion of a problem-free life. But the soul sees every fall into ignorance and confusion rather as an opportunity to discover the beast residing at the center of the labyrinth. There is also an angel. So he uses that metaphor of the beast within is really an angel in disguise. And that's soul work. He says, the uniqueness of a person is made up of the insane and the twisted as much as it is of the rational and normal. And I have to tell you, I do like your insane a little bit better than your rational. Because when I see a little crazy in there, I see the light coming through the crazy. Anybody resemble that? Oh, anyway. To approach this paradox point of tension where adjustment and abnormality meet is to move closer to the realization of our mystery-filled star-born nature. To move into the darkness, you meet the star. And then he goes to this Greek story, how it starts. He says, the Greeks would tell a story of a minotaur, a bull-headed, flesh-eating man who lived in the center of a labyrinth. He was a threatening beast, and yet his real name was Asteron. Asteron means star. And he says, and I often think of this paradox as I sit with someone with tears in their eyes, searching for some way to deal with death or divorce or depression. It is a beast, this thing that stirs at the core of their being, but it is also the star of their innermost nature. We have to care for this suffering with extreme reverence so that in our fear and anger at the beast, we do not overlook the star that's inherent within the beast. Wow, it's all saying the same thing, isn't it? You know, that we have this darkness, and in the darkness, the light exists. We have this part of ourselves that's frightened, almost a tyrannical aspect that we think is maybe our enemy. And in the old way of doing science of mind, Judy Graff remembers this, we would treat it away. We would affirm, I am not that, I am rather this. But in this new way of embracing everything, we embrace the part of us that's afraid, the part of us that we call the beast within, and to realize that there is beauty in that beast. I think there's a children's story about that. My niece and I, we would dance to that Beauty and the Beast when she was in her little petticoats, and I'm a 30-some-year-old man, and everybody's out on the veranda drinking. I'm dancing to Beauty and the Beast with my 5-year-old niece and feeling the message there that this beast is really beautiful within. So what if this is the counterintuitive thing? We're not here to fight the outer. We're not here to fix the outer. We're not here to heal, other than to do the healing work on ourselves, because we are the world. You know, when we do the work first on self, then we work in our small communities, our family, our friends, and then we can move into the larger community, and we realize that it's all us, and that everything is pointing us back to the truth. when Gigi and I were traveling around Turkey and we studied with the Sufis, we had just been to Konya, where Rumi lived, and we were given an audience of the whirling dervishes. And we even met the great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Rumi. Her name was something Celebi, and she was our host. And after this beautiful experience, you know, the dervish puts one hand down to the earth, the other hand up to the stars, and then they rotate round and round and round. And the idea is that each of us is a threshold between heaven and earth, and that this is the way the universe comes through all of us. And there's an equanimity there. The earth is as sacred as the universe. And so as beautiful as that whole experience was, when we got in the tour bus and we were driving through Turkey, and it was a very hot day, I saw on the side of the road an old dog that was nearly just shaking with his leaves, skinny as a rail, and right next to him was his partner. They looked like they had been littermates. They were mongrel-type dogs, and it looked like it was deceased. And Trey said, "Whatever you do, David, don't look out the window. It's the saddest thing I've ever seen. He tries to protect me from the world." And I looked out of the window, and I saw it as one of the most beautiful signs of devotion that the partner would stay with its mate. And as it looked up at me in the bus, I put my hands out, and I said, "I see you." I didn't see that this was a horrible sign. I saw this as a beautiful moment of devotion, that even in that, he stayed with his mate. The animals are such great teachers. I was telling the class, Trey and I go to Big Springs Park in the morning, and we walk the dogs, and because Humphrey's compromised because he was paralyzed, he can't really do the walk anymore, so he has this beat-up old stroller that we wheel him around, and Trey always wanted a child, so he just loves to push the stroller. And so we get there early in the morning, maybe it's 7 o'clock, and every morning we get there, out of the grasses come what we call the three amigos. They're like three old male mallard ducks, and they're always together. You're quacking and talking and quacking and talking. And so this last time we went on Monday, and all of a sudden a female had moved into the three amigos. And we thought, oh, isn't that interesting? Well, the most dominant of the amigos decided he was going to get rid of his two brothers. So he's snapping at one brother and snapping at another. And he's flirting with the little female mallard, and they're doing their thing. And we're both saying, don't give up your brothers for just a fling. It's just a fling. You'll get over it. You three amigos, you've been together forever. You know, you don't need to do this. Well, I felt like Larry David. So the next day we came back, and the three amigos were together again. And I said to someone, well, it was just a fling, and then he went right back to his brothers. And then some smarter woman said, nah, she got tired of him, and she went on and did her own thing, whatever it is. And so as we were leaving, going through this whole drama of what the animals were going through, I realized I had the wrong three mallards. Right back at their grasses were the three old amigos quacking away. They hadn't done that dastardly deed. I had projected all my frustration on another group of mallards. And, of course, my mind was running away with thoughts that it should look the way I think it should look. And I don't have a clue. I saw this wonderful Netflix movie. Trey's always watching these things on Netflix, and I don't have a clue what he's watching. But in this one particular movie, it had a theme of Socrates. And the basic theme was, Socrates says the unexamined life isn't worth living. And so you watch this movie of a very troubled man who finally does the work on himself, and he realizes through meeting his own darkness, his own monsters, he found the light within, and you see his transformation at the end. But what was the most beautiful part of the movie, and I don't remember the name of it, he came to a different realization at the very end. He went back to Socrates, and he said, Socrates also said, I don't have a clue who I am. And he said, I finally arrived at this journey after all this examination to realize I don't know who I am. And that's the opening to a discovery. Of course we can't know who we are because we've identified with me. Back to that video of Ajashanti in this recent interview, this woman asked him about awakening, and he says, you know, most people confuse the awakening thing. He says, it's like you're awakening from a dream. It's the dream of me. And when that which awakens from this dream arises, he said, oftentimes you don't know who you are because you'd identified so long with your successes and your failures, and that's not who you are. You're that which holds all of that. And when we stop identifying with the form, with who I think I am, that which is true can really flower within us. When we identify with where I'm being unloving, can we discover that's the obstacle to love, but the love never stopped flowing. So it's kind of counterintuitive. We're not here to get something. We're here to discover something that's been there all along, just waiting for us. And maybe the world needed a pandemic right now for the heart of humanity to awaken. I wonder. You know, when the AIDS crisis hit, I thought it was such a horrible thing, and it was a horrible thing. But looking back on it 30 years ago, it opened the heart of humanity to gay people. They began to realize, my neighbor's gay, my grandson is gay, John's stepson was gay. We all of a sudden had an identity other than just being a label. And in that, now we have the equality of marriage. Did it take that? I don't know. But something great happened because of that. So what if we, during this time of darkness, know that there is a light emerging, and we're here to see that light together? So let me do a little going within experience. And I start with unhooking from the thought, from the narrative, from the story of me. And as I unhook from that story of me, it's like that hot air balloon. The hot air balloon of my soul begins to lift off to the groundedness of my identities. You know, the balloon will arise when you drop those sandbags. All my accomplishments, I throw them off the balloon. All my failures, I throw them off the balloon. They have nothing to do with me. All the belief systems that I've held, I let them go. All the attachments that I've held, I let them go. And I see this balloon of my illuminated self begin to rise out of condition, out of form, into a spacious field of light and love, where I can look down and I can see all of that still exists. But I have, in this just this brief exercise, I have liberated myself from entanglement within it. I can see clearly now, because I've created space between myself and what the appearance of the world is. I have a perception of wholeness, as Ernest Holmes would say. And in that, everything is established in its wholeness, in consciousness. I don't have to get down at the level and try to fix the minutiae of the world. I can see the world as going through yet another growth experience. And so in that, I become part of the consciousness that is required. Helen Street, universe, beloved universe, assist me in assuming the consciousness that is necessary in my own life, with my children, with my planet, with my husband, wife, with my body, with my mind. Universe, assist me in assuming the consciousness that is required for the wisdom of the soul to reveal that which can't be understood, but which can be known. I'm no longer hanging out in the mind that wants answers, but rather I'm surrendering to that which doesn't need an answer, that says this too is good, this too is of God, and I demand to see the blessing, even in the darkest places. I take my little mirror out, and I shine the light into the darkest places, because I have a little mirror. And the Sufis say the one practice they do is what they call zikr, and the zikr is to polish the mirror of the heart. Again, another metaphor. So when my heart is pure, as Jesus said, I will see only God. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they see God in everything. And so as we cleanse this mirror of the heart, as we let the light shine through us, we see the beauty, the grace, even in the darkness. And we rest as that. There was a conference call with all the religious science ministers on Friday. And what they did was, for half an hour, they went into silence, and everyone prayed. Everyone held this high watch. Samuel Taylor Coleridge said, "He who loveth well, prayeth well. Everything and everyone. He who prayeth well, loveth well. Everything and everyone." And so what if we enter into that field of love that we all share? And like Rumi would say, we observe if there are any obstacles to that love. And instead of annihilating those obstacles, we surround them with light. And see, that obstacle is really an opportunity. If I've held anybody out of my heart, I no longer do that. In my mind's eye, I see those two dogs in Konya, and I place them in my heart. They served me by showing me what fidelity and loyalty are all about. Could I have the heart of that dog standing by its mate, knowing that that is my responsibility to be in that moment as a loving presence, not as someone to fix the world, but to someone who can just embrace whatever life brings and demand to see the blessing. So we make a demand on the universe, and we open our heart wide to discover something that can't be known, as Socrates said, and we don't have a clue what the result is going to be. But we know that our responsibility is here to bring the light, here to establish ourselves in a peace that passes all understandings, and to take the next step, trusting and knowing that life will bring to this jubilant and beholden soul everything it needs for its unfoldment. And it's all good, and it's all here for us. Claiming this right now, we become part of the solution and not part of the problem. With so much gratitude for our hearts united, we rest in a faith that passes all understanding and know that we are the light of the world. And all is well, all the time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. More information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new